Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, markets wobbling, a plane crash takes the life of Mr. Alaska, and fire and flood from Moscow to Pakistan midweek, a swoon on Wall Street.
Stocks getting slammed, the first full trading day after the Fed warned of a stalling economic recovery.
Former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens goes down in an Alaskan plane crash. He famously brought home the bacon. In 2008, he spoke about his loyalty to his state.
My motto has been here, to hell with politics. Just do what's right for Alaska.
And big flooding in China and worse in Pakistan, where one villager voiced outrage at Pakistani President Zardari, who had been traveling abroad.
They have promised with us, we will give you all the help, we will give you rescue. And now where they are? Our president in France, in London.
Where's our president? But there's flooding all over Iowa. You just heard it. Ames, Iowa, dealing with that this hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable. This week with Michael Crowley of Time Magazine, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you see in the economy, in the primaries, in the angry right, in Robert Gibbs and his White House slap at the professional left? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Michael, Byron, Jack, it's great to have each of you. Jack, let me come first to you on Robert Gibbs and taking off, talking with a reporter from The Hill about what he called the professional left and their expectations of this president. What did you hear there, Jack?
Well, I heard at least an effort, I think, and I think people are right to interpret it this way, as a sort of sister soldier moment, alluding to that moment in the 1992 campaign when presidential candidate Bill Clinton took a slam at that rock singer. And this looks like that. It's an effort to say we're not, these crazy progressives, a gesture, if you will, to voters in the middle. But it's strange when you look at the data on this. According to today's Washington Post, 85% of liberals approve of the job Obama is doing. Hard to get anything better than that. 88% supported health care. So there's immense support among liberals, at least to judge by that. However, the problem of enthusiasm remains, and I think Gibbs's comment worsens it. You know, there's been a pattern. The Democrats have had to compromise in order to pass their bills. That's resulted in weaker bills, notably with the stimulus, and it's demoralized liberals, leading to what is this continuing enthusiasm gap vis-a-vis the Republicans looking for the fall. It's narrowed that gap, but it's still about 11 points. And some people are saying, well, how do you revive that? How do you get liberals, you know, passionate again, or the base passionate? One easy way is to appoint Elizabeth Warren during this congressional recess.
There. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
To head the new Consumer Protection Agency.
To head the new Consumer Protection Agency in the Fed. That would get around a Republican filibuster, and it would be something Obama can do all on his own. There's no issue of compromising and so on. And I suspect that something like that may be in the works. She was at the White House yesterday. They said some good things about her. It would be an easy way to fire up at least the chattering class wing of the Democratic base.
Michael Crowley, Byron York, let's listen for a second to Shirley, one of the members of the professional left, MSNBC's Keith Olbermann, responding here on Tuesday to Robert Gibbs.
I really don't know if I'm part of the professional left. I really would rather not be. But the sad truth also is that these kinds of roles do not tend to be sought nor achieved. They tend to fall on you when others don't do their jobs. Because if there is a professional left, it's only because on a day like today, the White House has seemed more like the amateur left.
The amateur left. Michael Crowley, what did you hear in Robert Gibbs' jab?
Well, you know, I think I heard frustration, obviously. The White House does get pretty rough treatment from people like Olbermann, other commentators on MSNBC and talk radio. And I think that they feel like they don't get enough credit for the accomplishments that they have under their belt. I think that it's a continual refrain from Democrats in Washington that the what you know we have this new term that's been coined, the professional left out in the elsewhere in the country, doesn't understand how difficult the numbers are in the Congress, that they don't have a full appreciation for what it takes to pass things through the Senate right now. Even though Democrats have a large Senate majority, Republicans are still able to filibuster quite a lot of Obama's agenda, and that requires compromise. And I think that there's just a fundamental sort of dissonance between what the White House believes is achievable in the world we live in Washington and what people like Keith Olbermann think you could achieve if you fought harder. And I think that it just really frustrates and wears down people in the White House who believe that, I think, commentators like Olbermann, I think their view is, are just kind of taking a simplistic, easy soundbite route to sort of whacking them. And they're not really looking at the realities of what does it take to get Ben Nelson to vote with you and not join a filibuster on these things. And the outcome is not always what people like Keith Olbermann want. But the reality is that's what the White House is stuck with. And I think they feel like when they look at the health care bill they got, when they look at the financial regulatory reform they got, they are feeling pretty good about their accomplishments. They don't think they're getting enough credit.
Byron York, you've got a more conservative take. How do you see that? Olbermann stepped back earlier before that comment and went through a whole litany of things that he said. Look, the president promised change on the stump. That change spoke to us, liberals. We wanted it. We expected he won a big victory. We should have had it. We should still have it. What do you make of this White House pushback, Byron?
Actually, I kind of agree with Jack on the sister soldier nature of this. I think the main thrust of the Democratic campaign as we head toward November is please don't look at what we've been doing for the past year and a half. We passed a number of things that were generally wanted by liberals, and even though the liberals had lots of quibbles and arguments with them, that's basically things that the left wanted and the center and the right did not want. The polls told them that over and over and over again. So I think that this is, I think it's quite intentional, a move to just kind of reposition the president, the White House, as a more centrist force. Because, I mean, the anger that exists in the country, to the degree that it focuses on Democrats and the White House, is that they have pushed, they have ignored the opinions of the public on a number of things, the biggest one, of course, being Obamacare. So this is a way for the president to make the president appear more centrist.
Gibbs came out with, I don't know if it was an apology, not really a step back. Let's listen to how he described this under questioning, a couple of days after the comments first appeared.
I think many of you all have heard frustration voiced in here and around. Sure, I doubt I said anything that you haven't already heard.
But this wasn't a mistake. It was not something you said in error.
It was born out of frustration, but I don't think it was. I think it was born out of frustration.
Born out of frustration. That's nothing like an apology. Michael in Waltham, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, I'm hardly part of the professional left. I served as Assistant Secretary of Administration Finance for two Republican governors. I volunteered for two combat tours in Vietnam, and I'm very proud of it. That hardly accounts for me as one of the liberal left or the left, whatever. I just want to point out that I not only voted for President Obama, I'm also one of those many wonderful white New England people who probably teared up at his primary and his inauguration day. Now, I've been closely associated with politics for like 27 years. I'm scarcely naive about the legislative process, having worked for the executive branch of state government.
Michael, where are you going? Do you think Obama has not been ambitious enough? Is that where you're headed?
I'm building up my street cred here.
Okay.
But I am so disappointed in President Obama from his fear of going after the levels of people that ordered or condoned torture. I was so ashamed of that, having been, you know, a combat veteran myself. By the way, brought in so many VC suspects that I got a letter of commendation for it.
So now, be tougher, Mr. President, you're saying. Go for the change you promised. Michael Crowley, why not? Do you think the president's hit the right balance? Was this the maximum he could lean that way and still govern?
Well, you know, this is a philosophical question that It's sort of unanswerable, and it's a raging debate, you know, between the center left and the farther left right now. I'm not sure what the answer is. I tend to think that if when you bear down and you look at anything Obama wants to do has to get through the House and then has to get through the Senate. And when you bear down and you look at the numbers in the Senate, it is really hard to get the kinds of things that the caller, whose service, by the way, everyone deeply appreciates, to get the kinds of things he wants through that Senate, where you have pretty conservative Democrats like Ben Nelson, for instance, who are just not inclined to vote with the White House on a lot of the kinds of things people want. And they have got to come up with 60 votes to break Republican filibusters, and that is not easy to do. I would say the caller mentions the issue of torture. It's interesting to me how that totally fell off the radar. I mean, Obama essentially was able to say, folks, we are not having a big raging national debate, at least not at this level, about interrogation practices in the last administration. And, you know, he was able to kind of just put that thing behind him, and the left has largely, you know, dropped the fight. But it's always been interesting to me that that was not a kind of a bloodier thing than it was, and I'm sure Obama's very relieved about it.
Myra Newark, we've got a break coming right up here. We're going to come back and talk about Republicans winning in primaries and whether they're too far right to win in the fall elections. I mean, is anybody in the middle anymore, Byron?
No, not that much. I think if you look at the voting records of Congress over the years, Democrats have moved farther to the left, Republicans have moved farther to the right. The various groups that rate on either side that rate members of Congress, you know, given perfect 100 voting records,
yep,
their perspective, the number of perfect voting record people on both sides has been going up significantly. So no, we definitely are more polarized, and there are fewer people in the middle.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, market jitters on the economy, primary votes, and the White House jabs the professional left, fire and flood from Moscow to Iowa to Pakistan. Byron York of the Washington Examiner is with us. Michael Crowley of Time Magazine and our own Jack Beatty. A lot of mainstream GOP candidates not taking the prize this week. So it's a more Tea Party-leaning gang, a little large and in charge in the four primaries. We saw congressional primary elections held across the country, four states on Tuesday. Former World Wrestling Entertainment executive Linda McMahon won Connecticut's Republican nomination for the Senate.
People ask me every day, Linda, why did you decide to run for the United States Senate? And I can tell you it is because I had a great fear that the American dream was in the greatest jeopardy that it has ever been in our lifetime, and I didn't want to lose that opportunity for the American dream for our children and our grandchildren.
Yeah. Linda McMahon there in Connecticut. Byron York, take a look at us in Colorado. Ken Buck steps up and wins further right from further right than the Republican sort of mainstream candidate. Same thing in Connecticut. What's going on here? Does this bode well or ill for Republican candidates in the general midterm elections, Byron?
Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, I think the biggest news out of the primaries was the Democratic race in Colorado, where the White House candidate, Senator Michael Bennett, beats the challenger, Andrew Romanoff. But I think there is this, generally on the issue of Tea Party candidates, especially in the races in Colorado and in Kentucky and in Nevada, I think you've got those are the three probably big Tea Party-backed candidates, Buck and Engel and Rand Paul, who Democrats are hoping to portray as just too nutty to possibly win. The fact is they're all in very, very, very close races right now, and a couple of them, the Tea Party-backed candidates, are ahead. So I'm not sure that there's a lot of great evidence right now at this point to say that they're just too far right to win.
Michael Crowley, how do you read it? Too nutty to win? Is that going to be a characterization that sticks here, or is this real horsepower in the Tea Party-leaning candidates Byron describes?
Well, you know, to some degree, it will be a test of how well they can reinvent themselves. And I'm sure the National Party machine, having failed several times in a very interesting way to, you know, essentially select the candidates that they preferred in these races, I'm sure is now giving them quite a lot of advice about how do you having won over the kind of grassroots primary voters, how do you win a general election? And so you are now seeing these candidates kind of undo a lot of the, you know, quote-unquote nuttiness that Democrats have been attacking them for. And one example is that you do have Angle in Nevada, who has, you know, spoken derisively about Social Security as sort of a system that should be more or less scrapped, is now running an ad professing her great love for Social Security, and we have to make sure that it's fiscally sound, and essentially doing a 180. So the question is whether that will fly, and whether and Rand Paul, for instance, has completely stopped talking about his sort of interesting thought experiments about, you know, libertarianism and government, and is acting like a pretty conventional mainstream Republican. And the question is whether you know, this will fly, and whether Democrats will be able to portray them as the candidates they were in the primaries, number one, and number two, whether this reinvention will disillusion, their original supporters in the primaries, and these people will feel like, well, now they're kind of selling out and they're just like everyone else, and they won't have the turnout from their conservative base that they were once hoping for.
I guess you can tack to the center from the right as well as the left, but what's the winning strategy this year? Not so clear. Let's get a call from Kentucky. Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. David, you're on the air. What do you think of Rand Paul's chances?
I think that his chances are certainly no better than 50%.
It's not bad at this point. That's pretty good.
And if the media would stop being so thrilled over his name and giving him all this incredible play, I think that that he would pretty well go away.
What do you think about the Republican posture more generally in these races, David? What are you seeing?
I don't see much of a posture. Well, that's maybe all it is. Just simply posture.
All right. There's a call from Kentucky, and I appreciate your call. David, let's get one more here. Charles in Augusta, Georgia. Charles, you're on.
Yes. I think it's terrible that these hard right folks are trying to take over the country. The people think that we're in trouble now. We see what happened with the previous administration, and let these far-right people get in, it's going to be far worse. One of the other things, I really disagreed with one of the things the commentator said. President Obama has always been a moderate. He's always been willing to compromise, and that's what he's done. And the other thing is that, you know, it took 8 years for the previous administration to get the economy in the situation that it's currently in. And people think that President Obama is going to fix it in less than 2 years. That's really unreasonable, and it's not going to happen.
Charles, I appreciate your call. Jack, there's going to be a real test on this anger front this week. You had Martin Frost, Democrat out of Texas, saying the last few days that the concept of an anti-incumbent mood has been oversold by the right wing and repeated by a gullible press all year. Yet you can certainly find plenty of video and plenty of real meetings, Jack, where the fever is pretty high.
Yes, Peter Hart, the Democratic pollster, is calling it the Jet Blue election. People spewing invective and looking for the emergency chute. So it may well be that these seemingly extreme Republicans, for example, the candidate for governor in Colorado, believes that bicycle paths are, quote, part of a greater strategy to rein in American cities under a UN treaty. That sort of candidate may well, strangely enough, be in tune with the JetBlue electorate. We'll have to see. But on the anti-incumbent issue, I think Martin Frost has a point. According to something I saw this week, out of 282 federal-level officials up this year, only six have lost seats. The House reelection rates tend to be, they were 94% in 2006, which was a tough year for Republicans, and only 5% of the 119 incumbents facing primaries this year have lost. And in those losses, you can usually trace it to some idiosyncratic district-specific event. So it doesn't seem as if there's so much an anti-incumbent wave as a feeling against both parties. The Republican Party, according to the Wall Street Journal has never had a lower rating. The Democrats have a terribly low rating. Public seems to be saying they don't want either party, and yet they're going to have to vote for one or the other.
Byron York, look a little further down the road with us. We talked this week with Mike Huckabee, who, of course, was in the contest in 08, may very well be in the presidential contest again in 2012, and famously described himself, saying, look, I'm conservative, but I'm not angry. I'm not mad about it. We asked him if that put him in a tough spot looking toward 2012, and here's how he responded, trying to have it a little bit both ways. Let's listen.
There's certain things I'm angry about. I'm angry that our government is spending money it doesn't have and borrowing money that it can't afford to pay back. I don't think the tenor or tone of my speech is one of the veins bulging out in my neck and people seeing my face turn crimson. But there is a sense in which I think what I would say to them is anger is a good thing. It can be a highly motivational emotion, but you have to channel it.
Byron York, how do you think it's being channeled, and does it flow toward Huckabee, toward Romney, toward Palin? What do you see?
I get the sense now that conservatives and Republicans, there's certainly a lot of campaigning going on. People are going to Iowa, people are going to New Hampshire. But there is this sense in the Republican Party that this November kind of means everything right now, and that 2012 will sort itself out afterwards. So I think we've actually seen less 12 talk at this point right now than we saw at the comparable point in 2000 for the 2008 election. I think a lot of this conversation that we've had up till now about the congressional elections is exactly what Democrats want, which is let's make it about this candidate or that candidate, this challenger is really kooky, and let's don't talk about what Democrats have been doing for the last year and a half. The idea that Democrats, for example, would have talking points going into the November elections and they wouldn't be stressing health care is astonishing. The idea that the White House and Democrats talked for months and months and months about a pivot from whatever they were wanting to do at the moment to jobs and the economy, I think, and maybe the pivot still hasn't been made. So I think that you've got to face the fact that an election is going to be, to some degree, a referendum on the performance of the party that's been in power for the last year. The Republicans in 2006, for example, running for re-election in Congress, could not have effectively said, we want the election to be about the future. Let's not talk about what we've been doing. So I think that's going to be an enormous part of this election, and that's why Democrats are scared right now.
Maybe you're right. Then there's the party of no taunt from the other side. Winner in Colorado this week, of course, as you say, was Michael Bennett, who was put in there to take Ken Salazar's place when he went off to be Secretary of Interior, beat the more progressive Andrew Romanoff, who was backed by President Bill Clinton, interestingly, against the Obama backing for Bennett. Here's the newly victorious candidate or nominee, Bennett, talking about his win in the primary.
Washington is full of politicians who are more interested in scoring points and calling names than doing the hard work to turn our country and this economy around. And the gap between what we hear from the talking heads on television and what I hear in town hall meetings all across our state has never been wider than it is today.
So, Michael Bennett in Colorado. Let's get a call from Steve, Boston. You're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had two statements. I think the GOP will always have an advantage over the left, and that's simply because it's a lot easier to convince working Americans that government is stealing their money than it is to suggest that everyday Americans are making comparatively less due to globalization and the free market economy. Further, since one doesn't really learn about globalization and inequalities caused by the free market until college, when less than 30% of Americans go to college, it's much more difficult to get this kind of left message out. So just that statement.
Steve, we got it, and I appreciate your call. One more, Kathy in Lowell, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on.
Yes, hi. I just want to say that I'm pretty frustrated with the president, but even more with some of these commentators and their total inside-the-beltway thinking. We desperately need a politics of ideals and vision. And I want a president who fights for a vision that doesn't begin with compromise. And I guess the health care debate was one of the places that's emblematic of that, where they had the people who were fighting for single-payer systems ejected from their meetings. Of course there needs to be compromise. We understand that. To say that we're stupid and naive because we don't understand how the Senate works, we understand how the Senate works. We understand that. But if we don't have somebody talking about these bigger visions, educating people, helping people understand why the things that he's calling for, these policies that he wants, make sense and are good for us, we're going to continue to lose.
Kathy, Robert Gibbs was talking about this professional left. He described, he said, they will be satisfied when we have Canadian health care and we've eliminated the Pentagon. That's not reality. Is that what you want, Kathy?
Yeah, and that's totally insulting. Of course it is insulting. And it's. I think that what we're feeling is that the White House is doing the wrong politics. They're not taking advantage of the opportunity to really help people in this country understand the direction that he wants to go.
Kathy, I appreciate your call. We've got to put a cap on this in a second. But Michael Crowley, last word. What about the enthusiasm gap? Jack was talking about right at the top. You know, you've got callers from the sort of left side of the spectrum here expressing frustration.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, it's a critical problem for Democrats. And, you know, the White House right now is trying to figure out, I mean, key to Obama's victory in 2008 was these sort of first-time voters. You know, there was an idea that politics was changing and people were joining the system. There was a huge turnout surge. He won. He flipped a lot of states blue because people came out for the first time. It's not at all clear they're coming back. And I think it's because a lot of these people expected more. Now, I don't think Obama has necessarily dropped the ball. I think when you do look at the numbers in the Senate, it's been really hard for him. But I think people don't either buy it or in some cases, I think they don't understand it. This caller may understand it. I would, you know, if the caller was still on the line and we had more time, I would be interested in knowing how the caller thinks you could bring a senator like Ben Nelson around to supporting something like a public option or single payer health plan. I think the White House concluded it just wasn't possible. But there are people who don't buy that argument and they're not excited about voting for Obama and the Democrats in the midterms, and it's going to cost them.
Kathy talks ideals and vision. Yeah, Byron.
The problem with the, and certainly the Obama White House has to get the votes to pass something. The problem was they were, and with health care specifically, they were trying to pass something the public did not want.
So you say.
If the bill under consideration had a 65 or 70% approval rating, more senators would have come around. It would not have been a problem of getting to 60 votes. The problem was it was not a popular bill.
Of course, Kathy might say, well, maybe the president should have been on the stump more effective at making it popular. We've got too much to do here. I got to move on. The economy, a big wobble in the markets this week. Bad numbers from all over. A little brighter sign from Europe just in the last day here. But just to give you a flavor of what was people were talking about, here's Jim Bianco, president of Bianco Research. This is on Bloomberg Television Street Smart, saying there is now a 50-50 chance of another recession.
And you could see the market do a 20% correction, which is bear market territory. And typically when you get those types of corrections, you get all kind of reactions in the economy with reverse wealth effect and plunging consumer confidence,
right,
which could pile on to an already weakening economy.
Michael Crowley, you've been writing about the nightmare scenario of another 1937 situation.
Yeah. Well, right. You know, in the Great Depression, the economy started to come back and went back into the ditch again. And I think that there's a very real possibility we're looking at that again. I think the White House is concerned about that possibility, absolutely. The frustration at the White House is that they felt like, one way to stave this off would have been another injection of stimulus spending. Once again, we get to this question of the Senate and the Republican filibuster and the White House's inability to wave a magic wand and pass the agenda as it would like it. And so they are hoping for the best. They are working around the margins, trying to sort of fight, yard by yard to pass stimulative measures to pump more money into the economy. For instance, the, I believe, $26 billion or $22 billion that was recently passed for aid to states for teachers and Medicaid spending. But a lot of economists think that you need a number closer to $150 billion to ensure that we don't have a double dip. And if we have a double dip, all bets are off when it comes to politics in this country. It's a very scary prospect.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, signs of economic desperation in Georgia as 30,000 wait in the heat for help with housing. A mad scramble just to apply for aid. One woman explained why she was there.
The economy is bad right now, and they willing to offer assistance with housing if they are. You know, it's something you wouldn't want to pass up.
30,000 people for applications. JetBlue attendant Stephen Slater bailed out on the tarmac with a few choice words and a couple of beers after a dust-up with a rude passenger. Here's a witness.
It was a crazy way to quit your job. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, may we all be able to quit our jobs, you know, spectacularly, but just not get arrested in the process.
All kinds of hubbub over this, over Slater and his wild exit. Here's Jimmy Fallon's quick ballad saying, get two beers and jump.
When you're mad.
Get two beers and jump. Michael Crowley's with us. Byron York is here from the Washington Examiner. Michael from Time Magazine. Jack Beatty's here. We're looking at a week in the news. Market jitters on the economy. Primary votes. Gibbs on the professional left. Fire and flood from Moscow to Iowa to Pakistan. $26 billion passed in aid for states this year to deal with Medicare and teachers and more. Here's who do we have here? Speaking on the House floor, this was Steve Rothman, Democrat from New Jersey, rejecting Republican claims that the bill was a poor use of funds.
See who votes which way. The Democrats came up with this solution. We paid for every penny of it. We're helping the states, the taxpayers, and those in need. We're moving the country forward. We will not allow this country to go back to the policies that brought us to the brink of disaster.
The gentleman's time has expired.
We are moving forward, says the Democrat. Republican Minority Leader John Boehner condemned the vote as more spending the country cannot afford.
This bailout to the teachers' unions is some of the most irresponsible policy that I've seen. The American people are screaming at the top of their lungs, stop! And Washington continues to spend. Well, listen. I've been around my district, and I can tell you what, I've been around a few other districts. The American people know that it's time for the spenders to go and to have real fiscal responsibility here in Washington, D.C.
Fiscal responsibility, says John Boehner. Now, Jack Beatty, we've heard all week all kinds of things on this front, but you heard the business man just before the break there saying 50-50 chance of a recession. Now, what's going to stave that off here, Jack, and what about spending from the Congress?
Well, when you look at the size of this stimulus bill, $26 billion for the states, that's set against a collective budget gap in the states this year expected to amount to $140 billion. That is to say, the 50 Herbert Hoovers in state capitals are going to be doing their contractionary worst to make things to slow the economy next year, simply because they're forced to cut by their constitutions. It's only the federal government that has the power to engage in deficit spending. And without it, well, I think things would be much worse. There's no question about that. And, you know, this question of spending and of the economy raises a very interesting point. It speaks, I think, to something both of our other guests brought up. And that is that in the Great Depression, the years 1934 to 37 saw the fastest growth of any years in our history except for World War II. In other words, the economy was just roaring along. Sure, unemployment never got below 10%, but it came down from 20-something percent and came down fast.
And those were the stimulus years.
And those were the stimulus years, and that robust recovery won support for FDR's reform.
But the recovery went away, Jack, 1937,
poof. It did indeed, because the president made a very bad decision to tighten things up and pull back from stimulus. But the point is, Obama hasn't had that kind of economy to deliver support for his reform. It's just been reform, and people say, wait a minute, yeah, reform is fine, but what about my job?
Byron York, you've written very strongly, and many Republicans are talking about fiscal responsibility, Democrats at this point, too, in no small number, I guess, but what about the issue we're up against here with the economy? 50-50 chance of getting back into a recession. Do you see the possibility of a 1937 double dip here, Byron? And if it's not stimulus, and we know there's a debate over how effective that was, but if it's not stimulus, what protects us from that?
Well, certainly there is that possibility, although a lot of forecasters see just kind of a long, slow recovery, and have noticed that, yeah. I mean, jobs have been slower and slower to recover in the last several recessions. So there's a whole bunch mm-hmm. of scenarios, and then there's also the possibility that things could actually get better. This $26 billion that was passed is kind of the, it was a tiny little remnant of this Democratic dream of Stimulus 2. Democrats have boxed themselves in by passing much earlier in the Congress these so-called PAYGO rules, where they say that you know any new spending, you have to pay for it by corresponding cuts or, mm-hmm. or increased taxes, and then they want to accept everything. Well, this is an emergency. It shouldn't be subject to PAYGO rules. So what they did with this $26 billion, I believe, is fund part of it by cutting food stamp funds, I believe, in some out year, 2012 or
2014, I think. 2014.
But I have to say, the idea that food stamps funding would actually be cut in those years is just not believable. So I think this is a trick where you remove it now and you restore it sometimes later. But they have really boxed themselves in by they criticized Republicans for spending too much and not being fiscally responsible, and they were going to do better, and they passed a rule, and now they have to break it all the time.
Hard to come up with a big stimulus if you have to pay for it somehow when there's not much left in the kitty. Nick in Nashville. Nick, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi. What do you think?
Yes, I think that the people that have the money are actually holding on to the money and causing the problem itself, because the corporations are making the money. The shareholders and all should take less money and allow people to work. They could take a little less profit and put more people back to work, which would have moved this economy. But they're just holding on to it and trying to make Obama look bad so they can run him out of office and go right back to what they was doing, getting money at everybody else's expense.
You think it's a plot kind of here, a conspiracy to hold back on the Capitol. What do you say to Nick, Jack?
Well, I mean, I've heard that now. I mean, the phrase is capital strike. You know, the Business Roundtable is deeply hostile to the president. So is the Chamber of Commerce. By some estimates, businesses are sitting on something around $2 trillion of money they're not investing. And their argument is, well, why? The economy is flat. There's no reason. But liberals and others are suspecting, well, maybe there's another reason. Maybe they're just holding back as a kind of capital strike and saying, well, we'll get people by holding back, by making sure the Democrats don't get any kind of bounce for the economy. They'll help elect friendly Republicans.
But that would be a pretty big conspiracy. I mean, the profit motive is pretty strong. If people saw the chance out there, you would think, Jack, that would bust through.
You would think. And with consumer confidence what it is, it would be a very, audacious businessman investing in new plant and equipment today, especially with these latest figures showing exports way down. So I don't subscribe to it myself, but I think you're going to hear more and more of it.
Yeah. Paul in Albany, New York. Paul, you're on the air. Hello, Paul. Maybe we lost Paul. Let's get Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Paul, Alan, you're on the air.
Great show, as always. Love to listen to it. I have a statement here that I'd like to make and have your commentary to it. The big talk is about how it's Republicans are right wing and the Democrats, you know, are about jobs. But I think what's happening here is the Republicans are staying away from social issues like abortion and gay marriage and stuff like that, and just running on fiscal issues. They're running on issues of jobs and issues of lower taxes and lower government spending. And to the average American, that doesn't seem to be conservative.
Well, that's interesting. What does conservative mean anymore? Byron, how about it? Alan sees, you know, less emphasis on the social, a whole lot more on the fiscal. And, what is conservative now, Alan? What's up front?
Well, look, there's nearly 10% unemployment.
Yep.
And of course they're talking about the economy. The economy has been the first, second, and third most important issue for certainly since the crash. And listen, I've talked to Republican pollsters who watched what Democrats were doing, and their just mouths were agape last year. And they were saying, look, every day that Obama and the Democratic leadership are not talking about jobs and the economy is a day that they have lost, and they spent many, many, many days doing that. So one of the reasons, the two reasons you're hearing Republicans talk jobs and the economy so much is that, one, it's the most important thing, and two, they feel they have an advantage over Democrats who spent a whole lot of time passing a health care bill that most Americans were not in favor of.
But as the president said, I mean, the argument he made was that long-term we cannot have a healthy economy without fixing that health care system. Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks, Tom. I want to throw at your commentators, particularly Byron, but really the whole group, this focus on Obama this, why the Democratic talking points don't include health care and all that, that's all nice. But let's look at who the Republicans are and what their rhetoric is. Kind of a variation on P.T. Barnum's comment, you know, I think maybe a wacko is born every minute. And what you've got is everything from Newt Gingrich, supposedly a leader, talking about how there's a four-year-old aspect of him where he gets up every morning and thinks there's a cookie somewhere in the house, and his job is to go and find it. You've got Sarah Palin standing there blankly looking at a person who says she's a governor, she's this idiot governor, and when the woman says, I'm a teacher, Sarah Palin gets this blank look on her face. Oh, a teacher. My goodness. You've got people in Republican state races now talking about internment camps for immigrants. I mean, why aren't you guys talking about that? These people are crazy.
Well, let me ask you though, Steve. I mean, remember Ronald Reagan, rather successful in winning office, two terms, and he always talked about, you know, a pile of manure and the kid who thought there must be a pony in here somewhere. Isn't it kind of like Newt's cookie?
Sure, it may be like Newt's cookie, but also let's then look at what Reagan did to the deficit and the debt.
Yep.
The Republicans have no, there's no answer. They have no answer. Boehner sits there on national TV when he's pressed about tax cuts and how he's going to pay for them. Well, I can't believe that we would raise taxes on our people today.
Well, Steve, let us pick it up. Michael Crowley, I mean, it's not as though Democrats haven't piled on the tan man, John Boehner, with that sobriquet and, you know, been pretty tough on him. But Steve says, you know, there's not enough being called out here.
Well, you know, Democratic strategists would agree it's very much a part of their campaign strategy to keep this conversation going about eccentric and extreme things some of these Republican candidates have been saying. You know, I've seen talking points for House Democratic candidates which specifically encourage them to talk about the Tea Party movement, to talk about Tea Party candidates, to make the Republican Party and the Tea Party basically synonymous. This is something Democrats are quite happy about. Boehner specifically is very interesting figure in a slightly different way, which is to say that, you know, there are two things about Boehner that I find kind of surprising. I mean, one is the degree to which he has defended Wall Street. You know, he really attacked the financial regulatory reform bill and, I mean, has called for its repeal, in fact. If you look at polling, Wall Street is really the number one villain in this country right now. When voters are asked who is to blame for our economic crisis, about 20% of them say George W. Bush, about 37% say Wall Street. And Boehner has kind of been defending big business and Wall Street in a way that I find curious and not necessarily so politically shrewd.
Though a lot of Wall Street money has been shifting toward the GOP lately.
Yes, the money
has gone to
the
Democrats
Republican
over the years, that's for sure.
That may be the answer, that the spigot from Wall Street has moved to the Republican Party and they may feel like the money is more valuable than the optics. Very briefly, I want to tack on one point because Byron has mentioned several times the unpopularity of healthcare reform. And I just think to add a little more context to it, there are two things to note. One is that when it was so unpopular during the congressional debate last year, a lot of that dissatisfaction was coming from the left that felt that the bill did not go far enough. So it was not that this huge majority of Americans thought, oh no, this system is being imposed on me and I hate it. I mean, a good chunk of that was liberals who felt, go farther, please, this bill is weak tea. The second thing I would say is if you look at recent polling, the bill is actually now kind of a wash politically. It is not a huge political loser. I would concede that in some swing districts and rural areas Democrats are trying to hold, it probably is a loser. But overall, the numbers are pretty much within the margin of error in polling. And Republicans, by and large, are not talking about repealing the health care law anymore. Republicans thought they had a winning soundbite by saying, repeal Obamacare. That's not really at the core of their agenda anymore.
Though I still hear it out there, so I got to switch for just a second to the Pentagon. We had Ron Paul and Barney Frank on not long ago talking about big cuts in the Pentagon budget. This week it was Defense Secretary Robert Gates talking about moving away from the culture of endless money to a culture of savings and restraint. Here he is on Monday.
We must be mindful of the difficult economic and fiscal situation facing our nation. As a matter of principle and political reality, the Department of Defense cannot expect America's elected representatives to approve budget increases each year unless we are doing a good job, indeed, in everything possible to make every dollar count.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. Byron York, what do you see coming here on the Pentagon front? Can we, will we really knock down that big budget?
Well, sometimes you have a fight between the Pentagon and the members of Congress who just want to force money onto the Pentagon. I think even the strongest hawk believes that there is still plenty of money that can be cut in the Pentagon. Gates's plan to close the Joint Forces Command in Norfolk,
Virginia,
get rid of a lot of contractors. I think that's probably something that will work, and the people against it will be mostly parochial interests. So it strikes me as something that it's not an enormous dent in the defense budget. It does not hurt our abilities to, with our current commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. So my feeling is it'll go.
Jack, very briefly, on the Pentagon, on Pakistan, huge floods there this week.
Biblical floods. A fifth of the country submerged, 14 million people affected, 6 million need humanitarian assistance, 2,000 villages have been washed away. The death toll, well, it's low, 1,200, but expected to grow and grow fast and large. Evacuation of major cities, up to 400,000 people, and all of this with the federal government, according to one Pakistani writer, the federal government seems supremely unaware of the storm about to engulf it. People are furious.
Shades of Katrina there. Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Byron York with the Washington Examiner. Byron, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Michael Crowley with Time. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure.
And we say goodbye here today to our intern, Britt Hanson. You know, there's a lot of tough news out there, but when you see great young people coming up, you take heart, you take hope. We've taken that from Britt. We thank her for her time and all of her tremendous help over this summer. Britt Hanson, good luck to you. Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.